Now, if we scroll down to 911D, Joe, 911D provides us with a perfect example of how to understand this portion of our little lecture and resource visit to understanding the code. So glance down and look at your 7701A, you know, where they're not distinctly expressed. What does D in 911 say? And it says, for purposes of this section. That is the distinctly expressed. You can't use this definition anywhere else except in this section. And so what does that say? A qualified individual. Well, there's that word individual. The tax is imposed on what and who? Individuals. The term qualified individual means an individual. That's the number, let's call that A, you know, part, like little three part, part one, A. Individual means an individual, one, an individual. Two, whose tax home is in a foreign country. And three, and who is citizen of the United States. Now, I don't believe that the Secretary of Treasury was talking about D1A, qualified individual, in 1.1-1A, because where does it mention citizen or resident? Well, Joe, let's scroll down to D1B, just underneath that A. So if we're reading the definition of a qualified individual and keeping 1.1-1A in our mind, a qualified individual is an individual whose tax home is in a foreign country and who is a citizen of the United States and establishes to the satisfaction of the secretary, he's been a bona fide resident of a foreign country, or B, a citizen or resident of the United States, and who during any period of 12 consecutive months is present in a foreign country or countries. Notice that it says citizen or resident in B. So if we were to take 911D1B, drag it over to 1.1-1A and compare those two, you will see that remembering 1.1-1A, it says the code imposes a tax on the income of every individual who is a citizen or resident of the United States. So let me play a word game. Qualified individual means an individual whose tax home is in a foreign country. Who is citizen or resident of the United States? Every individual who is a citizen or resident of the United States. Does that make sense to everybody, or is there anybody confused? So I believe that section 1.1-1A, after 12 years of research, suggests strongly that the Secretary of the Treasury is talking about section 911D1B. The code imposes a tax on the income of every qualified individual, if you want to shorten it. And where is the income source for a citizen or resident? Section 911, it says, income from sources without the United States. So, is there a difference between 7701A1 and 7701A30? an individual who is a citizen is a qualified individual because Congress is telling us right there in that section 911D, it says, for purposes of this section. Now we can chuckle and say, they're not lying to us, but do you realize how closely we've got to pay attention? We've got to really pay attention to every single word that Congress gives us, and to this extent. And so at this juncture, we can go on and talk about other resources, but I'd like to open the floor to questions that we can talk about and discuss and get answers to. Can we do that, Joe?
We could do a little experiment, and we don't have a huge, or about half the group that we usually have. Some of the announcements got out a little bit late, but if somebody wants to chat me and say they'd like to actually ask the question orally, rather than typing it, just go ahead and chat me, and I will unmute you and you can ask the question, but you can also write your question as well. But you can see how Gary, well, everybody, all these, well, my co-hosts just enthrall and astound me. But I mean, it's just amazing when you drill down, you dig into this, which is the last thing that I'm sure that they want you to do. And unfortunately, we're a small population, right, of people that actually are willing to drill down, which, you know, by law, you'd have to, right? That's the law. These are the laws we're supposed to obey. But we do all the drilling down, and then the IRS agents don't, the judges don't. And so we're left holding the bag because we actually read the law.
That's it.
Right. And that brings up a few things, too. I'd like to tell everybody before they start, or explain to everybody before they start calling in or asking questions. There's some general maxims of law that are important when you read the law. As Gary is pointing out, there's nothing magical about reading these codes. In these code sections, you just have to pay attention to what they're saying and follow the statutes. There are, I don't know, thousands and thousands of statutes in the Internal Revenue Code and the regulations and the bulletins and the Federal Register. And to sit down and try to read all of this in one setting, or just say, well, I'm going to sit down and read all of this and start learning it, would be like sitting down with a shelf full of encyclopedias and say, well, I'm only interested in a few things, but I'm going to read it all. It's something you're just not going to do. However, Larry Beecraft made a very good observation last week, I believe, and he said, spend an hour a week, just 1 hour a week, and research the income tax, particularly the statutes and the regulations to get you going. Each statute has a regulation, or almost all of them do, which the commissioner tries to go and further explain the statutes the way he sees them. Though the commissioner may not always be right, the courts give great deference to the commissioner's understanding of the statute. But nevertheless, don't try to put all of this to memory as you research it and you read it. That's very difficult. I believe it was Einstein that said, I put nothing to memory that I can make reference to. I kind of like that. All you have to have is the general knowledge of what it is you're talking about or what you want to look at. The references are there for you to go to and specifically identify what it is or what the point is that you're trying to make. There's a couple more things that you have to realize too. When you read a section of the Internal Revenue Code or any law for that particular that the government is talking about, they're always titled. They're almost always titled. They have some nice title. Do not be swayed by the title. The title, section one of the Internal Revenue Code, could be How to Milk Your Cow. The title has no legal significance whatsoever when it comes to what's actually within the statute. So simply because you read a title of a statute does not tell you what that statute contains. You have to read the statute. And as Gary was pointing out, read it carefully. And if you the meanings are not always what you think they are, especially in law. For example, take the word voluntary, look it up in a regular dictionary. It's pretty forward. Then go look it up in the law dictionary. That's pretty forward too, but it's not something that you would think it would be. So there are definite and different definitions for particular words, as again, Gary was pointing out so well. And don't take anything for granted in these statutes. And do not ever read a statute by itself and say, wow, that's the cure all of all. As Gary just pointed out to you, it's not. It's not always the understanding. Congress does funny things. They write a statute and then they say, well, that was kind of general. We're going to have to find a way to implement it. And so what they do is they delegate their authority to the commissioner or some administrative agent says, here's what we mean, or here's what we said. Now you tell us what we mean.
Yeah.
And hey, they write a regulation.
And Sean, give us a definition of cow.
Well, there you go. Exactly. We back to the, go to the code. Because this is another thing too, is Gary is pointing out. You're going to read various titles and you'll go to various sections and subsections of these titles, and you will find out, and this is true in the Internal Revenue Code, for example, the term United States, if you go from one subsection to another subsection, you may find that the United States is defined specifically for that section, but for that section only, and then find out that it's defined for another reason or a different section, because now they're talking about something different when they use the term United States. So do not, as you read statutes, assume that, oh, well, this is simple because there's nothing simple about it. Here's what's simple. You read a statute and say, I've got it. You go into court and say, well, judge, the statute says that. The judge says, well, you know what? I understand that. But I have 100 court decisions that say, well, it doesn't really mean what it says. And he's not kidding. That's what the courts do. They try to explain to you the statute as though it's some kind of complicated beast that only so many people can understand. They don't always get it right. As a matter of fact, they don't get it right a lot of the time. Not to take anything away from them, not everything anyway, they have certain maxims and legal principles of law that they have to apply when they write or decide how to interpret laws. And when they go outside, well, we call it legislating from the bench, which is something they can't do. They can't write laws from the bench, or at least they're not supposed to. I won't say they won't do it. I don't say they can't. They shouldn't do it. They shouldn't, but they do it. And that's why you have courts of appeals and so on and so forth. That's why case decisions are very important. I've talked to a lot of people who say, well, I don't read case law because it doesn't mean anything anyway, and it's the statute that governs it. You know what? I wish the world was that simple. But case law does count. The courts today, whether you like it or not, and I'm not arguing for it or against it, I'm just telling you the reality of it. When you're going to research a statute and you've gone through the regulations and any other sources that you decide you need to look at it as, Gary was pointing out, the IRM manual, even though it's not law, is instructive. It gives you an idea of how the IRS is looking at it. So you get a behind the scenes look at what the government's argument is going to be based upon the Internal Revenue Manual and how the Internal Revenue Service looks at it. That's why that's a very good source. And knowing what the regulations and how the commissioner believes that this statute is interpreted is very important. There is a court decision out there, Supreme Court decision, and it's, which one is it, Larry or Gary, which says that the regulations that are written and the commissioner's interpretation of the statute has deference, I mean almost complete deference if it is reasonable. That's Chevron. Mm-hmm. And so what the courts do is they give, go ahead.
Lujan versus the Defenders of Wildlife.
And Lujan. Now, Congress doesn't like that. In fact, I've heard it over the last year and a half, maybe 2 years, where there's been some congressmen said, we have to write legislation to overturn Chevron, because Chevron stands for the principle that if the commissioner's interpretation is reasonable, not right, not correct, that doesn't count. But if it's reasonable, the court's going to adopt it. That leads to some very, very crazy results. And it opens it up for litigations if you know how to ask the right question of the court. But to do that, as Gary is pointing out, you have to research what you want to discuss, the statutes, the regs, and all the resources behind it. Because when you walk into a court, the only way you're going to win is if you know more than that United States attorney or that IRS attorney who's standing next to you. And giving the deference that's due to these attorneys, that doesn't take a real high level, because these folks are not trained ultimately to have real critical thinking. They're taught to accept certain principles, not question them, not look behind them. When the Supreme Court says something, well, then that's what it is. Well, that's not always so. If that was so, you wouldn't have cases like Plessy versus Ferguson or Brown versus State Board of Education, which cases have been reversed. Supreme Court's wrong, too. Supreme Court just reversed itself in another case, too, that was had long standing. So the courts aren't always right. That's the point. And simply because you lose in court doesn't mean that the judge got it wrong. You may not have done your research. You may not have asked the right question or phrased it in the correct way. And this comes back to what I was saying at the beginning. It's important that you have knowledge of the law. I don't care if you live in 1789 or 1989 or 2019, it doesn't matter. If the citizens are going to keep this country in the citizens' hands, they have to know the law, and they have to be able to research it if they don't know it, so they can come up to speed on a law that they want to challenge or that they want to know about in the event it becomes important to them. This is a duty to the citizens of the United States have, is to keep themselves educated. Because if you don't educate yourself, I guarantee you one thing, your government will. And I don't think you'll like the results when they get done educating you. Another thing, too, it's an important maxim of law. When you're reading a statute, and again, Gary pointed this out, every word has a meaning. Every word there counts. The Supreme Court and countless courts have told you, Congress does not fill up a statute with surplusage. In other words, they don't use words in the statute that aren't needed to express the intent of the statute. Every word counts. Every word has a purpose. So don't gloss over words when you're reading a statute. They're very important. It goes to what's known as statutory interpretation. The courts have several different maxims about how they go about interpreting a statute, and it's very important as you do your research and learn about the law, why certain statutes are interpreted one way and they aren't interpreted another, so you know why it's being done. You should be learning about statutory interpretation. Larry has spoke these terms several times over the last few weeks, and that's what it is. The rules that the courts have when they sit down and say, okay, here's a statute, here are the questions. Now we have to interpret this statute in accordance with the rules we've laid down to interpret it. And one thing about statutory interpretation, there's an outstanding principle. It's probably the one top on the top of the list. If you challenge the constitutionality of a statute and the court can find any other reason to uphold the statute other than the constitutionality of it, they will address that issue and they will never touch the constitutionality of the statute. So when you go in to challenge the constitutionality of the statute, it's up to you to, you carry the burden and show the court that it's unconstitutional and there is no other reason that they could possibly say the statute is okay before getting to the constitutional question. You have to be able to challenge them on all fronts. Anyway, I'm giving you this information in a general mode. So as you go through and you read court cases, and as you read the statutes, you keep these principles in mind so you don't read something into the statute that isn't there, or you read something into the statute or out of the statute. Remember, read what's written and go from there.
Anyway, I'd like to take a poll real quick. Everybody that was here when I was explaining Section 1, the regulations of Section 1, and then going to the Title I definitions, talking about 7701A1 and 7701A30. And then I went over to Section 911. How many people, with a show of yes or no, fully understood what I was talking about from Section 1.1-1A all the way to Section 7701A1 and A30? back to Section 9/11, how many people were able to follow that? Just say yes or no. Just in the chat.
As you read that, I just was glancing down at Mark's question. The proponent of a rule bears a burden of proof. Well, to an extent, but if you're challenging, you go into court as a plaintiff and you challenge something, you bear the burden of proving your right. The other party does not have to prove they're wrong. You have to prove your right. And this is one of the maxims the Supreme Court has, all statutes are presumed constitutional. So you walk in there and the court sits down and says, okay, you're challenging the constitutionality of the statute, that's fine. It probably needs a good challenge, but keep in mind one thing for sure. The statute is presumed constitutional for purposes of this discussion. So go ahead and explain to me why it's not.
Now, S. Angle said, no. Why don't you say what's your conclusion from what you said? I thought I did in some words. But okay, Section 1.1-1 talks about every individual is a citizen or resident. Section 9/11(d)(1)(b) says every individual is a citizen or resident. You go back over to 1.1-1a and compare Section 9/11(d)(1)(b) with 1.1-1a, and do you see the similarities? Is kind of what I'm pointing to.
Might be, you know, that's why we have the archives of the show. We can't put them right out, but we try to get them there. You can watch these videos as many times as you want. And as I let my email list know, the more you view the videos, the more people you send to view the videos, the better off, the more videos we can put up because it really comes down to where they're posted at Brighteon.com is, and there's a lot of great videos there, by the way, from all kinds of.
I'd like to go on to answer Mr. Engel's question a little bit further. We don't want to give you conclusions to tell you the truth. That's not the purpose of the show, is to make conclusions for you. The purpose of the show,
took the words right out of my mouth,
is for you to go read the law and you make your conclusions. Because when you go in to defend yourself or you go in to challenge something, and you explain to the court, well, you know, this is what Sean O'Connor told me. I'll tell you how the court's going to be in my conclusion. They're not. So it's important that you form your own conclusion based upon what you're reading and your reading of the statute and the law that surrounds it.
And Charlotte made a good point. I kind of understand it, but I'm not sure that I could defend it, the position. I wouldn't want you to defend any position on one particular point, especially one that's just thrown out just to show how they arrange the code, how they arrange the definitions, because to me, I think this is this one of the strongest examples of how Congress said, we're not going to lie to you, but you better listen very carefully. Don't want to really push a legal conclusion on you beyond the point of just saying you can see how confusing it is, because Mark said he doesn't understand it. You kind of understand it, Charlotte, but you know, other people don't understand it. So this is going to be, you know, a very important lesson, not only from a standpoint of challenging your mind to dig into the code to start flipping through those pages and reading them, because there's other supporting evidence and documentation and authority in the code that's a lot more important than saying what you're not, you know, because you need to say what you are rather than trying to prove a negative.
Yeah, and like if people picture, you know, a massive haystack, and let's say you've got a congressman standing there with you with a little needle in his hand, and that congressman represents the last 100 years of Congress. And he says, see this, here's the truth. And then he chucks it into the haystack.
Good point, Joe.
Well, you know, I'd like to offer Cassandra something also. I understand what you're saying. You're talking to some folks that have been dealing with these issues for a collective. I mean, when you throw Larry and all of us into the hoop for collectively over 100 years. So there's a lot of knowledge here. I would offer Sandra this, is that as you go through the statutes and the regulations, I noticed, I think it was either, well, Charlotte said she doesn't understand the position, or she understands it, but she couldn't defend it. So Charlotte, what I would do is go ahead and do your hour of research a week and pick a particular subject or part of the code that you're trying to understand. And as you go through it, write down the questions that you have. And at the next webinar that we have, say, okay, now I read what you talked about last week, and I'm trying to put it together in my mind, and here's a sticking point I have. Give me a better understanding, your understanding of it, so I can see if it meshes with mine, or if I'm looking at something wrong, or if it's just up for debate. I would suggest that would be one way to clarify your understanding. As Larry said last week, I believe it was, is don't take our word for anything. It's very complicated. It is. It's so complicated, in fact, that there's this maxim of law known as every man is supposed to understand the law and obey it. That is, the law is supposed to be understandable even to the most common man. The courts long ago, and so did Congress, understood that the tax code is so complicated, nobody can understand it. I believe Reagan confirmed that for us when he was a president. Ununderstandable, he said, needed to be fixed. It's something they can't fix because they don't understand the damn thing. But nevertheless, it's your understanding of the tax code that's important. Congress has said so. It says that you can't have the intent to violate the tax laws if you have formed a belief based upon what you have read about the tax laws, even if we don't like your understanding. You have to actually read it and say, well, I understand what it means, and now I'm going to violate it, as opposed to, I read the law, and here's what I believe it said. And this gets very interesting, because you can sit down, I don't know, a dozen people, have them read one section of the Internal Revenue Code, and to get consistency out of their understanding would damn near be impossible. And that's why the tax code isn't held against the people as well. Everybody knows, has to know the law. That's not true when it comes to the tax code. It's because it's so complicated and you give it a good effort to understand it, your understanding, even if the government thinks it's wrong, can't be punished. That's what they say. That's what the Supreme Court says. That's what the Congress has said.
And remember that, I mean, even though we're not going to just go back through what Gary and Sean pointed out, remember that for your homework, you know, for that hour you're going to spend, I believe everybody's seeing this as I share it. You know, I started with startpage.com. Can't stand Google. Google is evil. And so you can type in code of federal regulations. It gives you choices here. I went to the GovInfo, which is govinfo.gov, and then see my next browser tab. Remember how it took us to GovInfo? And I mean, you can spend the rest of your life here, as much time as you want. It's all right here at your fingertips. I mean, when I was investigating this stuff before I left the IRS, you know, I had to go down the street to the law library, and I'm not complaining. But, you know, I had to turn pages. I had to get books out of shelves. And I know Sean and Gary have even done a lot more than I have. So it's right here at your fingertips. And throughout each show, we do our best to show you how you can drill down. And so you have the buzzwords that we talked about, you know, Gary did, individual, and how key that term is. You can look at 1.1-1, the regulations, section 1, the statute, section 911. Those are all things we talked about just tonight that you can spend a fair amount of time on. And then when we post the video, you can test what you put together against what was said. You can watch it as many times as you like.